think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own.
Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome, and the whiskey is neat.
Hello, this is Rupert McKenzie, and you're listening to the Outlander podcast.
Welcome to episode 161 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. This week's episode is brought to you by Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients make a real difference, so it's important that you know where your food comes from.
Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. So they set the highest quality standards for their community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers.
And for less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. So this week, I made seared chicken and caramelized vegetables. It was amazing. I consider myself an okay cook, but this was above and beyond anything that I've cooked in the past. I'll preface by saying from scratch. It was this delightful bed of like buttery mashed potatoes covered in caramelized onions. And it says vegetables. The vegetables they mean were like, it was onions and fennel with like fresh thyme. And that was all caramelized with the chicken that was seared and these cherry tomatoes. And I am not a tomato fan, but anyone who knows me knows that. Fresh tomatoes are not my jam, but these were roasted cherry tomatoes that like just bursting that were cooked. And they all just kind of went together. And it just, the perfect bite was a little bit of chicken, a little bit of potato, a little bit of the caramelized vegetables, and like half of one of the cherry tomatoes. I mean, this was bomb. I mean, I could not get enough of this. I've eaten it like 2 days in a row now. I'm excited to finish it tomorrow. Like, I have not been disappointed with anything that's come from them at all. To be honest, this was probably the least amount of ingredients I've received with a Blue Apron meal. Like, when I opened it, I was like, literally, there was fennel, some garlic, an onion, two potatoes, and some chicken. I was like, done, let's do this. For me, the more ingredients means it's a weekend meal for me because of my work schedule. But this one, I got home, I saw the box waiting for me. I opened it up and I was like, this I can do. And I could, and I did, and it was amazing.
So check out this week's menu and get the first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/outlander.
You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/outlander.
Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
So announcements this week. We got notification that there is a book coming out shortly entitled The Official Guide to Seasons 1 and 2, The Making of Outlander, the series. So The Official Guide to Seasons 1 and 2 of The Making of Outlander, with an introduction by the one and only Miss Diana Gabaldon. And it says, we're dropping The Making of Outlander, a Delacorte hardcover on sale. It'll be on sale October 18th, 2016. It's an exclusive look behind the scenes at the first two seasons in this official, fully illustrated companion to the hit Starz television series based on the best-selling novels by Diana Gabaldon. It's the perfect gift for any Outlander lover. So again, The Making of Outlander, the series, the official guide to seasons 1 and 2 by Tara Bennett, with introduction by Diana Gabaldon. is coming your way in October of 2016. That's what I got, Ginger. Did you have anything?
Well, we got something.
Oh, really?
I think you can go ahead and announce the read-along song.
Oh, what am I hearing?
You are hearing our new Voyager read-along musical theme. When we heard this, I almost cried. Summer the robot almost broke, not in tears, but in disbelief. I mean, we couldn't believe it. I couldn't contain my, I couldn't stand it. I think you can tell. It is amazing. It is by a young composer named Dallas Crane.
All right, look, y'all. This is how this happens. When somebody messages you and says, hey, I'd love to write you some theme music for your read-along, our expectations are not high. I'm not going to lie. I don't know that our expectations are anywhere near what was actually delivered. Like, when we opened this email, no. I think my jaw dropped. And I was like, are you kidding me? I think I cursed. And I sent Ginger a text message. I was like, are you effing kidding me right now? Like, this is above and beyond anything I would have ever expected. This, you got me, bro. This is amazing.
You got us both, bro. And we will mention his name and this attribution, as well as his website, in the post that accompanies the show, so in the show notes. But his website, in case you'd like to go there right now before you even read the, you know, obviously you're not driving, hopefully. His website is dallascranemusic.com. Dallas Crane Music, as C-R-A-N-E, like the bird, music.com.
And he didn't tell us his mother and sister's names, but apparently they are listeners. So Dallas Crane's mother and sister, thank you so much for listening and sending him our way.
But oh my gosh, I could just sit here like dumbfounded and talk about how amazing that was. So, oh my gosh, well, you know, give some love to Dallas, you guys.
Love, but on that note, start it again.
Let's listen to it one more time.
This week, we are discussing chapter 6, entitled, Being Now Justified by His Blood. Whose blood? I think we all know whose blood.
Well, a few's blood.
Well, the main, I mean, the main blood was shed by young Fergus, but I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yes, you are. You know I don't like that. Okay,
I know you don't.
So, title, what I wrote before anything else, and I mean, it's so common that it would be silly for me not to think that, but all I wrote was, surely this is even more biblical allusion. And yes, it was. Ellen G. writes, this is Romans verse 5, chapter 9, the English Standard Version, quote, since therefore we have now been justified by his blood, much more shall we be saved by him from the wrath of God, unquote. Lisa T. writes, being now justified by his blood is from the Bible, Romans 5, 9. I think that it refers to Fergus. We learn how the story of the Dunbonnet unfolded. Now, personally, she says, I hope we get to see Romain, do this scene. He is so wonderful as Fergus, and I couldn't agree more. This is reminiscent, she says, of BJR taking the mallet and breaking Jamie's hand, though poor Fergus loses his hand altogether. Jamie, again, is helpless, like a hiding grub. Dude, Lisa, you gotta always take us back to that little lean-to, don't you? Stop it. Joe B. writes, March 1753, and Fergus is about to create the name of the rocks that will begin the search for Jamie in 1968. For 2 months, Jamie stayed in the cave or close to it. The English were still around. There was a path that came close to the base of the hill near his cave. Finally, we find out how Jamie spent some of his days. Just in front of the opening of the cave, if he sat in just the right spot, there would be enough light so that he could read. He'd have the odd book that he'd bring down from the house, one which Jared was able to smuggle among his other gifts from France. Now, the passage that he reads is Robinson Crusoe. And as he reads, the shadows moved, as the bushes above him moved. The wind shifted, and he hears voices. He gets himself back near the cave's entrance, and he sees a flash of red and metal on the path. He knew that because they didn't have the ability to traverse through the terrain otherwise, the soldiers would likely remain on the path, which meant he couldn't leave his cubbyhole until dark, even to pee.
Now, are you, Ginger, done being mad at Jared for being a Jacobite since he's still sending him stuff?
I don't want to talk about Jared. Ellen G. writes, and a bit of Robinson Crusoe by Daniel Defoe, Chapter 5. And she gives us a link, and we will include that.
Now, I can't think of last name Defoe without thinking of William Defoe.
William Defoe, me too. That's the only, I'm like, oh, no, that wasn't him. He sees the soldiers who surrounded a small figure, which we find out is Fergus, who was carrying a small cask. He was bringing the cask to him, to Jamie. Now, Jamie sees Fergus arguing with the soldiers, quote, gesticulating violently with his free hand, unquote. Jamie wills him to just give over the cask. Fergus was being insolent and dodging their attempts to grab the cask of ale. He continued to insult them, and the leader of the men halted them, thinking Fergus might be a decoy. But four of the men continued their pursuit and hurled themselves at him. There was a scuffle, and one of the soldiers drew his saber from his scabbard. And this scene is one of those that is so life-changing for two major characters in the rest of the series that it deserves, I think, to be included in its entirety.
In all the commotion and above the whining wind, Jamie couldn't have heard the rush of the sabre being drawn from its scabbard, but ever after felt as though he had, as though the faint swish and ring of drawn metal had been the first inkling of disaster. It seemed to ring in his ears whenever he remembered the scene, and he remembered it for a very long time. Perhaps it was something in the attitudes of the soldiers, an irritableness of mood that communicated itself to him in the cave. Perhaps only the sense of doom that had clung to him since Culloden, as though everything in his vicinity were tainted. At risk, by virtue only of being near him. Whether he had heard the sound of the sabre or not, his body had tensed itself to spring before he saw the silver arc of the blade swing through the air. It moved almost lazily, slowly enough for his brain to have tracked its arc, deduced its target, and shouted wordless, "No!" Surely it moved slowly enough so that he could have darted down into the midst of the swarming men, seized the wrist that wielded the sword, and twisted the deadly length of metal free, to tumble harmless to the ground. The conscious part of his brain told him this was nonsense, even as it froze his hands around the granite knob, anchoring him against the overwhelming impulse to heave himself out of the earth and run forward. "You can't," it said to him. A thready whisper under the fury and the horror that filled him. "He has done this for you. You cannot make it senseless." "You can't," it said, cold as death beneath the searing rush of futility that drowned him. "You can do nothing." And he did nothing. Nothing but watch as the blade completed its lazy swing, crashed home with a small, almost inconsequential thunk, and the disputed cask tumbled end over end over end down the slope of the burn, its final splash lost in the merry gurgle of brown water far below. The shouting ceased abruptly in shocked silence. He scarcely heard when it resumed. It sounded so much like the roaring in his ears. His knees gave way, and he realized dimly that he was about to faint. His vision darkened into reddish black, shot with stars and streaks of light. But not even the encroaching dark would blot out the final sight of Fergus's hand, that small and deft and clever pickpocket's hand, lying still in the mud of the track, palm turned upward in supplication.
I mean, if that does not give you a little bit of chills, I don't know what would.
I mean, but how far away from them how close was he that he saw that much detail? I mean, I know he doesn't have bad vision. He clearly has better vision than I do. I don't know that I would have been able to make all of that out from my vantage point in the cave.
He's not in the cave. He was in front of the cave reading.
I know, but he held back. He didn't go and rush to them because he didn't want...
Because he didn't want to bring attention to himself and put everyone in danger, because what Fergus was doing was giving himself up, basically.
Agreed.
So this scene, wow, so sad. Fergus sacrifices himself to keep Jamie safe, and his hiding spot is secure. All this to protect his Milor. And Jamie, knowing very well that he was powerless in this, if he were to keep himself protected and thus protect his family and honor Fergus's sacrifice, was forced to silence and impotence.
What do you think they did with the hand?
Oh, my Lord. That's a question. Do you think that's what happened to the plastic bag?
I know. Do you think that, right? Do you think that
the mysteries of Voyager?
Do you think the soldiers took it with them?
I'm sure they I don't think so. I hope they buried it. Don't know why.
The soldiers wouldn't have buried it.
The family.
But here's the thing. Do you think they cut it off and delivered Fergus to the family? In which case, they either took the hand as a trophy or left it in the mud. I don't think they took it with them and, like, delivered it and Fergus together.
I think they would have taken it with them. And, yes, I think they delivered Fergus, because they wouldn't necessarily – they probably would have seen Lallybroth there.
They would have delivered Fergus, but I don't think they would have delivered Fergus and the hand.
I don't think they would have left the hand. That's just creepy and nasty. But I, no matter what, I think I will definitely say I don't think they took it as a trophy, because – they were grossed out. They did not mean for it to go that far. They were not happy about it. And the captain, again, whatever it's worth, gave Jenny some money. So they definitely were sorry, again, too little too late. But no, I don't see them taking a child's hand as a trophy. That's just disgusting.
Can we put that on our list of things to ask Diana if we ever talk to her again?
Sure.
Okay. Put that. Make a note of that.
What a horrific, awful thing to have to watch. This isn't the same as Faith's death, I know, but this was a willing sacrifice. So in a way, it's not worse, but isn't it its own category of awful? Or awful sad? Awfully sad?
It's awful.
Ugh.
But it's silver lining awful. It's that awful that kind of makes you kind of go, oh, Fergus.
Exactly. So through this sacrifice, Fergus, who was already adopted by Jamie and Claire, ties himself to Jamie into perpetuity. He is now and forever linked to him, dependent upon him, and Jamie is forever responsible for him. It will be interesting to see how this progresses throughout the books, and I can't wait to see this devastation performed by Roman.
I know, but I love this line, though, when he's like...
We haven't gotten to that. We haven't gotten there yet.
I know, but I'm going to say it because she's already said... He's solidified his relationship, his place with Jamie. So since she's already said that, I'm going to say this line because I want to say it.
It's not she, it's me. That's all me.
Well, then you said it, so I'm going to say it. But I love that in this one line he says, and this is typical Fergus, "So I'm fortunate, for in one stroke I am become a gentleman of leisure, no?" And I love that. It's just that outlook that Fergus has. That
he's young enough to still...
To still find that as being like a silver lining. Like, yeah. This is the same boy who found... joy in his circumstances while living as a pickpocket among whores in a whorehouse.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to find the silver linings in his life. Then he still has that. And I think that's something that carries through with Fergus his whole life.
Ellen G. writes, "What an internal battle Jamie had going on. If he moved to protect Fergus, the English would catch him. So he stayed there grasping the granite knob and knew he was about to faint. Quote, but not even the encroaching dark would blot out the final sight of Fergus's hand, that small and deft and clever pickpocket's hand, as we read earlier, lying still in the mud of the track, palm turned upward in supplication." I just think that is it's sad and gross and devastating what happens, but it is a beautiful line. Joe B. writes, "This is the last stroke for Jamie. He will risk himself, but not others. Jamie waits 2 full days for word. Robbie finally whistles on the path below the cave, and Fergus, he finds out once he gets to the house, will be all right. No fever and no trace of rot in the stump, yet.
It seems the soldiers were a bit shaken up by the act. The captain gave Jenny a gold sovereign. Because that makes it all better, right?
Well, he thinks it does.
Ellen G. reminds us that Jenny was taking care of Fergus, and she's done this before with amputated limbs, so she knows what she's about.
That's so sad.
I know. Now, Diana's description of Fergus as Jamie enters is priceless. Quote, Fergus was lying in state in the nursery, ensconced in a bed by the window. His eyes were closed when Jamie entered the room, long lashes lying softly against thin cheeks, unquote. Like lying in state. Oh, what an apt description. And I can only see Romain now. I can't see anybody else.
Well, he's like, like lying in state is a funeral for a dignitary or king or queen. So, but not in state in that regard. Like he's not a dead body in my, like I see what they're saying, but it's to me, it's like almost like laying in what might be his deathbed, being attended to by all of his ladies in waiting. So I could still see the laying there like royalty in his infirm. But not, I don't know, do they do in state for people that are also dying, or is that just for the ones that are dead?
No, that's dead. It's dead bodies. Diana continues, quote, seen without its customary animation, his usual array of grimaces and poses, his face looked quite different. The slightly beaked nose above the long, mobile mouth gave him a faintly aristocratic air, and the bones hardening beneath the skin gave some promise that his face might one day pass from boyish charm to outright handsomeness, unquote. If only they could supersize Romain. I would love for him to be adult Fergus, too, in some way, if it were possible. Also, we get another mention of, quote, an aristocratic air associated with Fergus. Jamie kneels by his bed, and he apologizes to him. When he asks if it hurt much, Fergus says, well, not so much, and Madame has been most generous with the whiskey, which, of course, he hasn't drunk much of. And Fergus's sense of humor hasn't left him. He reminds Jamie of his promise as he took him in from the streets of Paris. Quote, I have been fortunate. Do you not recall our agreement when you took me into your service in Paris? I don't know why I'm doing a French accent now. I've never done it for Fergus, ever. You told me then, should I be arrested and executed, you would have masses said for my soul for the space of a year. But if I should lose an ear or a hand while doing your service, and Jamie finishes, I would support you for the rest of your life. Jamie doesn't know whether to laugh or to cry. He does, of course, remember what he said, and he will keep the bargain. Fergus, as Summer says, so I am fortunate, for in one stroke I am become a gentleman of leisure, non? Eileen P. writes, Fergus's defiance of the English soldiers while he's attempting to deliver a cask of ale to Jamie reminds me of Aesop's fable of the scorpion and the frog. A scorpion and a frog meet on the bank of a stream, and the scorpion asks the frog to carry him across on its back. The frog asks, how do I know you won't sting me? The scorpion says, because if I do, I will die too. The frog is satisfied and they set out, but in midstream, the scorpion stings the frog. The frog feels the onset of paralysis and starts to sink, knowing they both will drown. But he has just enough time to gasp, why? Replies the scorpion, it's my nature. And I'll link to that as well. That is actually one of my favorite of the fables. I remember that for decades now. So after he has lost his hand, again, this is Eileen P. continuing. After he has lost his hand defying the English soldiers because of its nature, Fergus looks on the bright side. The loss of his hand means Jamie will support him for life. This ensures that Fergus will be with Jamie, his father figure, for life, and he will be considered a gentleman. Jamie chose not to stop the soldiers because he knew Fergus would blame himself for Jamie's capture. At that point, Jamie had no idea Fergus's hand would be cut off. Would Jamie have stopped the interplay between Fergus and the soldiers if he had known Fergus would lose his hand? By doing so, Jamie's family, tenants, and Fergus would have suffered the consequences of harboring Jamie. In the end, Jamie ensured Lallybroch and its tenants would profit from his capture. So Jamie asks Jenny to join him in the priest hole. He has to chat quickly and then return to the cave. Now, Summer, remember how I said that I wanted a priest hole? Well, now I am severely reconsidering that request. They be tiny.
I'd do better in a cave for a week, being able to at least get out into nature than be in a priest hole. Did this change your mind about what a priest hole would have been like?
I mean, it was always assumed that it was going to be small, tight, and dark.
Yeah.
Like, not a place that you'd want to hang out.
But you can't lie down in it. You have to sit. I mean, how awful is that?
I mean, as long as you could lean against a wall, I could nap in almost anything.
Diana describes it as being no more than 5 feet square. Square. That does not mean 5 feet by anything, or it doesn't mean square. No furniture other than a small bench, a blanket, and a chamber pot. A jug of water, a box of biscuits. It was only added in the last few years, so not really a priest hole since no priest had been in it. But it was a hole. So he waited till they were both in the hole, and then the panel above was replaced. He tells Jenny that he must go. He cannot stay in the cave anymore, while those around him continue to be in danger. But he has no escape plans. He will let himself be captured. Jenny is shocked, of course, and sure he'll be hanged. But Jamie has thought this through. He tells her that Claire had the sight, that she had seen what would happen at Culloden. And Jenny sees this and accepts it, and recognizes the reason for her saying to plant potatoes and build the priest hole. The Crown would go on hunting Jacobite traitors for some time, he relates, and that after the first few years, they would no longer execute men, only imprison them, as per Claire.
And it had been how many years?
Probably a few more months, so seven? Almost seven. Well, not quite seven, because he's in the hole for... In the hole. He's in the hole for, like, probably 20 minutes. He's in the cave for, they say, 7 years. And the last chapter we talked about the timeline, it was only 6.5. So all in all, by the end of this chapter, or at the time he gives himself up later on, it's about 7 years. But right now, it's not quite 7 years.
So, but he thinks... And rightfully so, logically, that he's past
the danger point,
the stage where they are just killing willy-nilly no matter what. Now they're just arresting.
Well, no, they'll still, well, they would kill people they arrested. But what Claire was saying is that only for the first year or so after Culloden would they arrest you and then execute you. Now they'll just arrest you and throw you in prison, either for the rest of your life or who knows how long. But yes. Jamie's plan is to arrange for his surrender. There is a good price on his head, and someone that of his choosing or of their choosing should at least benefit from it. Jenny points out the risk of being killed as he's being captured, to which he replies, "Do you think I care?" Now, it took a while to finish all of the arrangements. Almost like an event you're planning, right? I guess it is an event. So it took more than 2 months. And what vision do we have of Jamie that last night of freedom? Quote, "He sat on his favorite rock near the cave's entrance, watching the evening stars come out. Even in the worst of the year after Culloden, he had always been able to find a moment of peace at this time of day. As daylight faded, it was as though objects became faintly lit from within, so they stood outlined against sky or ground, perfect and sharp in every detail." Unquote. This is another mention of twilight, one of the between times. Another allusion to or metaphor for times of change, times of closeness, times of travel. Claire at the stones at Beltane, or Samhain, as in the show. Jamie is no stranger to prison. He's drinking in the night sky because it might be a long time until he sees it again, if ever. He thinks of Fort William, of Wentworth, and of the Bastille. No fresh air, no light, and surrounded by filth, stench, and hunger. And he finally searches the sky for his own constellation of Taurus, which is very representative as he is both stubborn and strong. Ellen G. writes, "The evening stars are his only consolation, a thing of beauty that he can watch and find peace. He is such a man of nature, and by living in the cave, it has made him more aware of nature and her changes. A whistle alerted him that someone was coming up the path. It was Mary McNabb, a kitchen maid at Lallybroch. She brought a basket fully laden with supplies. Mary lays out their picnic, and they go over the final details of the plan. A horse would be brought up before dawn, and he would ride out to the narrow valley and turn as if he were going to come home. The English would meet him somewhere, and the place that they had agreed upon for him to turn around at was a good place for an ambush." So he was not only giving himself up, doing it in a way to, like, basically make sure it happened, because that would not have been good if he actually didn't get taken.
Now, McNabb, that is from the Rabbi McNabb.
Yes, it is.
Yes. That's his mother?
Okay. So Merry unfolds his bedding pallet on the floor of the cave and sits. He understands what she's going for and says, "Not gonna happen." She leans forward and kisses him. He pushes her away and says no, but his body says yes. So basically, Jamie's all, "Lord, show me how to say no to this. I don't know how to say no to this, but my God, she's wearing a dress. And my body's saying hell yes." As he pushes her toward the entrance, she unfastens her skirt. She's like, "Dude, you can like push me. You can do whatever you want to me. I'm just going to keep taking clothes off." Pretty soon, if you don't take me in, I'm going to be standing. I mean, it's nature. Probably no one's out there except the animals. But, you know, I'll be standing out here in my knickers or in the chemise, whatever. Which she, in the end, she's standing there only in her shift. Now she knows what was between him and Claire, and she won't make him feel he's betrayed her. She wants to give him something different, something to keep him whole. Something his, and this, I don't know why, but this made me laugh. Something his sister and the kids can't give him.
Well, I should not say,
well, that's correct, Mary McNabb.
Well, I mean, physically, it's always possible, but it's disgusting and that shouldn't
exactly
happen.
So he accepts her offer and they both move in. Together, they will, quote, "remember how it is," unquote.
So in one chapter, Jamie has doubled his number.
Yeah. And that's the only time you'll ever double something with one. Ellen G. writes, "He tells her no, but his body is saying yes, and Mary knows." Eileen P. writes, "I loved the gift from Mary McNabb on Jamie's last night before his planned capture. When Mary McNabb says, 'You've given me my home, my life, and my son. Will you not let me give you this small thing in return?'" unquote. I thought, such a noble and thoughtful gift. I would have done the same. Me too, Eileen, because I am just that noble and just that thoughtful. Donna Kay writes, "Not sure if the title of this chapter refers to Fergus or Jamie, but this would not be the first time that Diana's writing has had dual meanings. So Fergus knows that losing his hand now gives him lifelong security owing to the promise Jamie made him in Paris upon hiring him to be a pickpocket. Fergus never knew who his parents were, and Jamie, while being his employer, was also effectively the only father figure he ever had. Losing his hand, his blood, had given Fergus not only a sense of security, but also a justification for Jamie to continue caring for him as a son rather than as an employer." Interesting outlook. I didn't think about it that way. "As for Jamie, Jamie knows that sacrificing himself, his blood, his liberty, to save and continue to support his family and tenants is the only way he can justify having survived Culloden when so many died and he lived. He has tried for years to support them by hiding out and hunting at night, and it has not been enough. He may believe that he has not suffered enough for his sins, and that additional sacrifice is necessary to justify continuing his life. The gift of Mary McNabb that she gives to Jamie, and that he eventually accepts, is a very unexpected but very tender scene that is justified by his sacrifice for the last 7 years. He doesn't think he deserves it, but we know he does."
So when you first started that whole thing, and you said you did, she wasn't sure whose blood it was, it made me think of Outlander. And I believe it was Rupert who asked Jamie after the first time if he'd bled. And I was thinking, I was like, it wasn't his first time.
Joe B. writes, "In sleeping with Mary, Jamie accepts her gift rather than payment for his protection. Mary knows what he has had with Claire and is giving Jamie a chance to remember that. It's not a replacement. As she says, it's something he can use in the future. Once Jamie has established that Jenny is not behind this, he takes the offer as an act of gratitude and thankfulness from Mary." Now, I think this is one of the few times we see Jamie let his body overrun his mind. Whilst it's an act of grace to accept what Mary is giving, if he truly felt this was a betrayal of Claire, as he has before when Jenny has brought up the subject of remarrying or even sex before, or a misuse of Mary as much as his body may want release, he would have refused Mary.
So is this like the equivalent of like Mary washing Jesus's feet?
I mean, her name is Mary.
I know, I'm just saying.
Lisa T. writes, "Tenderness and pity. So just as Claire found solace with Frank, so Jamie finds a moment of peace and tenderness with Mary." And finally, Martina P. writes, the most surprising part of Chapter 6 was definitely the courage little timid Mrs. Mary McNabb displayed by offering her services to her laird. Now, I don't know if services is the right word.
I don't know if courage is the right word. I mean,
he's not a bad...
He's not hard on the eyes. No. I mean, it's not like she's really taking one for the team.
No. Again, the bairns can't do it, and the sister can't do it, so there's not really a long line. While I must say that she uttered very convincing arguments for her case and Jamie was receptive, I dare to point out that her mission was not quite as selfless as she put it. This experience might have been little Mary McNabb's, quote, Thornbird moment, unquote. I will leave it at that.
I'm just saying, if you're going to, it's not like she was taking one for suffering. The team for Arthur Duncan. I mean, think about it. It's not like,
oh gosh,
there's no suffering on her part.
Oh Lord.
She gains to do nothing. She stands to do nothing but gain good things out of this encounter, I'm sure.
And maybe a baby. You never know.
Oh God, I'm just saying. I hope not.
I'm just saying this part
Can
of the book, we don't
book
know.
10? Book 10 may have some
little Jamie McNabb. Oh, it wouldn't be McNabb. It would be little Rabbi Fraser.
He might know, but if she, well, I don't. They might not have recognized him as a Fraser, so it might have been a McNabb.
Could I be mean, James the mom's McNabb. Name? Oh Lord, have mercy. I don't want to put this up out in the universe, but dude, that would be so funny if Diana came back with that. I would laugh. I would cry. I would laugh so hard. I would cry. Joe B. writes, Sam Heughan, in interviews looking toward series 3, has asked, who is Jamie without Claire? In many ways, he's the same. He cares for his people as much as he can, still much trusted milor to Fergus, and loved by his family and tenants, and still a traitor to the crown. The difference is in why he will risk for them. It's a willing sacrifice, a beneficial sacrifice, as his reward will feed his people, and it's something meaningful he can do, rather than feeling inactive in his cave. A difference in Jamie is that he cares so much less about himself, unquote. And that's again from an interview with Sam Heughan. Somewhere, we don't have a link for that. And Joe B. continues, parallels between Jamie and Jesus are strong here. He will sacrifice himself willingly for the sake of those he loves. Again, there is a Last Supper and a woman named Mary ministering to him. The woman who washed Jesus' feet isn't ever mentioned in the Bible. For a long time, it was thought to have been either Mary Magdalene or Mary, the brother of Lazarus. Either way, having Mary McNabb, who has been, in essence, saved by Jamie, offering this last act of love for him is a reinforcement of the Messiah theme used here. Once again, our commenters kicked our booties. So thanks for that, people.
If you've read the Da Vinci Code and you believe in those kind of stories, there's a whole faction of people who believe that Mary Magdalene was actually Jesus's wife and was written out of the Bible.
Oh yeah, there's a whole bunch. One of my favorite books that, again, it's alternate on the history because that's a loaded word. Fiction, definitely fiction, but it's a beautiful story. If you can read it as entertainment, and definitely food for thought. One of my favorite books is by Calista Kinsler, and the book is called The Moon Under Her Feet, and that is in reference, I believe, to the woman in Revelation, the moon beneath her feet. On top of the moon, starving the moon, something like that. I think you'd like it some. It is very touching, and it's very, I read it with knowing it's fiction, but it's so moving, and it's a kind of along the themes that Summer just talked about. I can give a link to that as well, because it's one of my favorite books.
And that was Chapter 6, Being Now Justified by His Blood. Join us next week when we begin Part 3 of Voyager, entitled When I Am Thy Captive, with Chapter 7, A Faith in Documents.
So as we head out, let's play that Voyager. I'm going to call it our Voyager theme now, our Voyager read-along theme. We'll play that one more time. And again, thank you so much to Dallas Crane, who is actually a film composer. He composes music for films. And again, his website is dallascranemusic.com. And you can find him on Twitter at Dallas Crane. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. And thank you so much, Dallas. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our Audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/OutlanderPod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.